The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Looks like the 2020 presidential campaign is really getting started. Could we see over 140 million voters?
If this thing got up into the 140s, near 150, I don't think I'd be surprised. And I don't have a handle on who those extra voters, if you will, are going to be.
And as major cities burn and become sanctuaries for rioters and violent criminals, President Trump makes a commitment to help with federal officers. And that proves unwelcome by mayors and media.
To send this federal police force to the city of Chicago, ironically, run by a black female mayor, and the president seems to have issues with any women, but especially a black woman with power, Lori Lightfoot, the mayor of Chicago.
The key question on coronavirus is whether or not to resume school. Some governors seem to be doing the bidding of the teachers' unions. Lonnie Chen weighs in.
Kids, school-aged children, are far more likely actually to have a mortality, to die because of influenza, the common flu,
right,
than they are because of coronavirus.
I'm Mark Davis, in this week for Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. You can catch my talk show daily on 660 AM The Answer in Dallas-Fort Worth and on the web at 660amtheanswer.com. Join me on Twitter at Mark Davis, and of course, follow this program as well on Twitter at Town Hall Review. Let's begin with a look at the fast approaching election. Things are getting more and more surreal these past few months, but nothing more so than the actual candidates and their actual campaigns. Let's look at the challenger. Joe Biden has been doing most of his work speaking from his basement. Meanwhile, the president's been working harder than ever, helping the nation sort through the pandemic, work through some civil unrest, easing economic uncertainty. So it's almost August. When do we, if we ever do, see some real campaigning, maybe a real debate or two? My colleague Hugh Hewitt spoke with NBC's national news correspondent Steve Kornacki.
And so I brought up to you last night, and I want to explore with you two things. You brought up the shy Tory based on John Major's surprise vote, where a lot of people didn't want to admit they were going to vote for Major, and he won in England. I brought up the 2019 Brexit referendum, and for anyone who wants to know about that, go watch the movie starring Benedict Cumberbatch as the wonderful Dominic Cummings character. They went out and found 3 million new voters, people who weren't shy. They just had never been there before. Which is more likely, if either of those, Steve, to be at work in the 2020 electorate, if at all?
It's a good question, because this is more than any other presidential election, you know, in my lifetime, certainly. We don't know what the electorate is this year. One thing that I've been noticing, you know, a lot of these primaries, you know, in the last few weeks, where you've had a lot of them, not all of them, but the places where you've had extensive mail-in voting, we've seen very high turnout. You know, we've seen numbers. I was looking at Kentucky, for instance, the other day. You know, they had a Democratic Senate primary there, you know, to go up against McConnell. The numbers in Kentucky, you know, ballots returning, not just Democratic, I mean, Republican as well. You know, they were looking at turnout there that rivaled their highest of all time. And you know, the races this year arguably weren't even as interesting in Kentucky as they've had, you know, in some past campaigns. So I think there is a possibility that the number gets way up there this year. You know, it was about 130 million, you know, was turnout in 2016. I mean, if this thing hit 140, if this thing got up into the 140s, near 150, I don't think I'd be surprised. And I don't have a handle on who those extra voters, if you will, are going to be, because I think the mail-in dynamic changes it. It just seems, looking at primaries in these states, that given that opportunity, more people are taking advantage of it. Maybe it has something to do with the pandemic and being at home and having nothing else to do. I don't know. But it seems that more people are taking advantage of it, and it raises the possibility to me of a dramatic increase in turnout for this thing.
Now, Steve, on the landing page of the Post today, I have a editorial on the dangers of confirmation bias. The Trump supporters want to believe that the new voters you talk about, the difference between the 130 million who voted last year, and I think you just said the maximum of 150 million who might vote this year, are Trump people who never voted for Ford, the Brexit voter. They're coming out of the woodwork. They're not saying anything. They're shy. They're afraid. They don't want the static. They don't want to be called a racist. But the left believes it's the African-American vote that is energized. It's the Latino vote that's energized. Is there any evidence of either of the confirmation bias responses that one or the other has more probability than the other?
Yeah, I think where it gets a little complicated on that to me is if it's the Trump factor you're describing, I don't think we're going to see it yet. Because, you know, Trump's had an uncontested, you know, run to the Republican nomination, and these have been, you know, he's been sort of just playing out the circuit here, kind of. Whereas you've had these Democratic primaries, you know, Biden, Sanders, you've had, you know, big Democratic Senate races. So I think we've kind of been testing more the Democratic side of it than the Republican side of it. I really think it's going to take a competitive Democrat versus Republican, Trump versus a Democrat election, you know, to test what you're talking about.
Meanwhile, I don't think I need to remind you of this. We have the real makings of actual revolution going on today on the streets of some major American cities. No sooner did that CHOP experiment settle down in Seattle that Portland and Chicago have now turned alarmingly violent. Sebastian Gorka sought out Acting Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security Ken Cuccinelli.
So is the deployment of federal officers a function of the skin color of the local mayor, Ken Cuccinelli?
No. In Portland, you may have noticed the mayor is white. He's wacky, but he's white. and to your point, it is not about anybody's skin color. It's about law and order and whether violence is present or not and whether more officers are needed to keep the peace. That's what it's about. These are professional decisions made and professional advice given to the president. You've heard him talk about how upset he is about the violence. And these are violence where the victims are in cities that voting for him, but he still cares about these people. He wants them safe. And if local political authorities usually won't let their police do the job, then the president is prepared to try to expand our enforcement capacity in these cities to bring peace there.
Some people have literally said that what your colleagues are doing is, without announcement, without identifying who they are, trampling on the civil rights of the people they pick up in unmarked vehicles, that this is some kind of secret police activity. Why is it important? I was with the president last week. He really is very concerned for what's happening in these Democrat-run cities. What is the mission of these officers across this nation? Why are you having to send them to these cities?
So that's a great question. So let's stay with Portland, shall we? And the courthouse there, the Hatfield Courthouse, was built in 1997. And since 1997... an agency called the Federal Protective Service. Most of your listeners have probably never heard of it because most of their day is very quiet. But if you've walked into or out of a federal building, the odds are you have walked by an FPS officer, either right, one of their officers or one of their contract officers. So they've been defending these facilities for over 20 years, and intelligence we got at the beginning of this month going into the July 4th weekend was that there would be more targeted violence directed at these federal facilities. And so we backed up our FPS officers as we back up any of our partners.
Do you have enough manpower? Do you have enough technology and training for these people to do what they need to do? Because as you said it, the FPS service, that's not their daily job. Their daily job has usually been rather quiet. But to don tactical gear, to go into places that have been simply devoid of police safety and security because of a lack of local political leadership is not the everyday mission of the FPS. So is there any concern at DHS or in the White House that you may be stretched too thin, or is everything within the envelope of what you need to achieve?
So first of all, everybody there in a situation like Portland is trained for the work they are doing. There is no problem on that front. We do not have endless manpower. We expect state and local officials to keep their community safe. Literally, the first responsibility of government at all three levels is public safety. And we only have to expand our presence, it seems, in those cities where they refuse to perform that most basic job of government.
So how are we doing as a country to get ourselves free of the pandemic? I had the chance this week to talk with Admiral Brett Girard, an actual physician and our Assistant Secretary of Health. This is from my program right here on 660 AM The Answer in Dallas-Fort Worth. What's your overview, 30,000-foot level, of where we are with the virus and the response? And then we'll get to some specifics.
Overall, we're all very concerned about the outbreaks that are occurring, primarily in a lot of the Sun Belt states. We know that the infection rate is increasing over the last few weeks. Now, it is true that we're doing more testing, so the number of infections nationwide now compared to April is about the same or less, but we are seeing more infections, we're seeing more hospitalizations, but we are in a much different place. We really do know exactly what to do. We have widespread testing so we can understand where the outbreaks are occurring. I have CDC teams in every state. We visited 19 metroplexes with surge teams. We've responded with some surge testing capability across the country. And we know that you really don't need to close down, but you do need to limit indoor bars and restaurants, wear a mask when you're in public, do physical distancing and hand washing. And you can pretty much achieve the same thing as a total lockdown. So we're in a much better place, and we're starting to see the new tide turn again.
Are you hearing, noticing, because all we have are statistics that are given to us by people we'd like to be able to trust. I think the vast majority of people are trustworthy. The vast majority of people doing the reportings are shooting straight with us. But you hear these occasional ragtag stories of all kinds of folks show up to get a test. They didn't get the test. The lines were too long. And then they get a thing in the mail that, hey, your test was positive. Various counties, this thing right here in Texas in Corpus Christi, 85 babies test positive, and the panic cult goes nuts. Well, that's since March. When one family member gets hit with it, they test the whole family. So it's hard to even keep track of whom to pay attention to.
Yeah, it really is. We are pretty transparent. We're very transparent with all our numbers. I mean, we've tested over 47 million people, well over 700,000 per day. And our turnaround times, remember, the turnaround times that you hear in the news, that's only from the large commercial labs. And on average, it's about 3 days. It's not 14 days. I track this every single day, morning and night. I know by state. But half the testing is within 24 hours because it's done at point of care and local. So there's a lot of misrepresentations and sort of misinformation. But, you know, we're trying to be transparent. You know, I'm on TV as much as possible. You know, even in Dallas, there's some sort of misrepresentations of the truth, which kind of got me motivated to get on the show about some recent editorials in the Dallas Morning News.
Coming up,
what I'm getting at is that the Black Lives Matter now has dropped all pretenses that it's going to work within the traditional contours of American culture and history.
The revolution lurches leftward. Victor Davis Hanson, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back. It's the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. I'm Mark Davison this week for Hugh. You know, it wasn't long after the horrible death of George Floyd in Minneapolis that we started to see protests emerge nationwide. Those protests quickly turned violent with looting and widespread destruction. And now violent protesters and shadowy anti-American movements have come out into the open in places like Portland. The thoroughly legitimate cause of adequately addressing police brutality has now morphed into a denunciation of Western civilization. But if that sounds familiar, that rejection of the American experiment altogether, that's been happening in college classrooms for decades now. Sebastian Gorka turned to Victor Davis Hanson, author, professor, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution.
Your latest piece is entitled, Will 2021 Be 1984? You discuss this seeming cultural revolution occurring in America in the last few months, but you make the stunning observation that the person who is at the forefront of it, the putative nominal candidate for president on the Democratic side, seems to be unaware that there is a cultural revolution occurring. Please expand on your analysis.
Well, Joe Biden is not running a traditional campaign. He's been in his basement, and he will stay in his basement until Trump gets back up to 45 in the real clear politics, because it's a rope-a-dope strategy. And while people will be very protective of Joe Biden during the campaign and keep him out of sight and out of mind, should he be elected, then they will start a gossip campaign to remove him and have a real progressive vice president. This was all predicated on the virus, the lockdown that has made everybody anxious and has allowed Joe Biden to stay in his basement in a way that we've never seen in our lifetime a candidate do that. And so we can't say, well, Joe Biden was not physically or mentally up to the rigors of a campaign, because he can answer back, no, it's just because of the virus, the lockdown.
And then you paint this picture that should Joe Biden win the election, almost instantaneously, there will be a whisper campaign. There will be rumors from well-placed sources in the White House or the DNC in a very sympathetic mode saying he made the great sacrifice, but now he's not in a position to actually execute the functions of president. And then that will herald the entry of an America that could not have otherwise been realized in a normal election year.
Well, I think now the left has given up on the dream of Martin Luther King, that to judge people or assess them by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. And I say that because just in the recent last 10 days, we've had to have Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Charles Barkley come out and lecture black musicians, athletes, to stop this rampant, unapologetic anti-Semitism. We've seen places in the federal government, the Pentagon, Seattle, where there is, I guess you would call it white re-education, where people are selected on the basis of their skin color to go through particularly mandatory indoctrinations. What I'm getting at is that the Black Lives Matter now has dropped all pretenses that it's going to work within the traditional contours of American culture and history. It sees itself as a black separatist movement that has moral claims on the country, and in reparatory fashion wants things from the majority, and then intends to continue to define its privilege on the basis of race. This revolution is also very strange. It's not like the 60s, because the aging 60 liberal in the position of power has been forced to join the revolution. In other words, in the old days, they were opposed to the police tried to keep order. The army, the military was there if you needed them.
You know, it can be acceptable to miss a haircut or a night out to the theater, but having your school-age kids at home every day is taking its toll. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom has again bent to the teachers' unions, blocking all schools, public and private, from reopening. My colleague in New York, Kevin McCullough, turned to Lonnie Chen, an editorial board member with Salem and a fellow at the Hoover Institution. This is from AM 970, The Answer, in New York City.
In every state across the country, I have heard on some level fear from some mom saying one of two things. Either I'm scared to send my kids back to school, or I'm afraid the schools aren't going to open. Which is having the prevailing viewpoint, and why are we having this debate at this time?
Well, it's tough, Kevin. I mean, I understand both of those perspectives, by the way, and I think that there is good reason for people to feel the way they feel on both sides of this. I will just say this. I think that we're having this debate, and it's becoming so politicized, because everything in our society is pretty politicized right now. But look, going back to school, this should not be a political issue. This is really an issue of education. It's an issue of public health. And it's an issue of what is the right thing for our kids. And we know from all the scientific studies, and we know from all of the research that's been done, that kids do best when they are in school, in person, in an environment where they are learning from a teacher live, and when they're interacting with kids their age. We know that to be true. And we also know that there are huge public health risks to kids not being in school. We know that kids who are not in school are more likely to have physical issues. They are more likely to have behavioral issues. They are more likely to feel and self-report as feeling sad or depressed. We also know that kids not being in school means that they're not going to be prepared for the jobs of this generation. They're not going to be prepared for college or for whatever it is they want to go on to do. So there are a lot of risks to our kids not being in school. So I just wish in this debate, you know, I understand the concern about coronavirus. I get it. I just wish that people would understand that there are really some serious risks to our kids not being in school as well, which is why I believe in many parts of the country, in fact, in most parts of the country, kids should be going back to school full time in person.
Let's talk about the science on this for a second. I was shocked to find that when coronavirus and children or pediatric medicine are cross looked at, that, yeah, we had about 2,300 kids during the main thrust of the virus contract the virus, which is actually lower than what I would have pictured it to be, given the number of confirmed positives that we have. Of those 2,300, about three died with the virus in their system, but not in a single case did the CDC say that the virus caused the death, or even did they identify it as an underlying contributor to the cause of death in those three children's lives. In other words, Lonnie, we don't have a single recorded death at the cause of COVID-19 as it relates to kids. And we've changed the viewpoint. Evidently, Mr. Fauci and others have changed the viewpoint on just how contagious asymptomatic carriers are. So if they're not likely to be infecting everyone around them, and evidently they fight the virus pretty well, it's hard to say that from a science standpoint, they shouldn't be back.
First of all, it is the case that kids, school-aged children, are far more likely actually to have a mortality, to die because of influenza, the common flu,
right,
than they are because of coronavirus. Yet we have not shut the schools down for an influenza pandemic in many generations. The second point is, when you talk about kids transmitting the virus to one another, we have a significant amount of evidence from Europe where they actually have reopened schools. The kids are not very effective transmitters of this virus to one another or to adults. And the evidence suggests that they are very poor transmitters. The point about kids is simply this. It is highly unlikely that you are going to see, in my view, based on the science, that you're going to see significant negative impacts on the health of kids because we send them back to school.
The complete conversation of Lonnie Chan and Kevin McCullough is available at townhallreview.com. Coming up, China and COVID-19.
Should we hold China accountable for all of the cost of doing that to the economy, to the American people, to every lost life? Absolutely.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They're preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Mark Davis, filling in for Hugh this week. Shortly following the outbreak of COVID-19 in the U.S. last winter, it became pretty clear that the virus originated in China. Compelling evidence arose showing the virus had come from the Wuhan Institute of Virology sometime in 2019. Any doubt about the origin of this pandemic is now lifted following the recent escape to America of Dr. Yen from Hong Kong. Stephen Mosher is the president of the Population Research Center. His latest book, how do you like this for timing, is called Bully of Asia, Why China's Dream is the New Threat to World Order. He was a guest of Steve Cortez on AM 560 The Answer in Chicago.
Listen, a lot of Americans, let's face it, are in a pretty sour mood right now because of all the situations we've been put in, all of the economic hindrances that have been thrust upon the entire world by China crashing the global economy, all of the health restrictions upon America. There's a lot of division, obviously, within America. It's a tense and sour mood right now, unfortunately, in the country. And I think it's important, though, for Americans to realize that no American caused this situation. The only people that we can blame for this are the Chinese Communist Party. I want to play a tape of Trump. He talked about this 2 days ago in the Rose Garden. I want to just play a quick snippet of Trump and then get your reaction, please, Stephen.
Make no mistake, we hold China fully responsible for concealing the virus and unleashing it upon the world. They could have stopped it. They should have stopped it. Would have been very easy to do at the source when it happened.
So, Stephen, your thoughts. Is Trump being fair there in laying the blame at the Chinese Communist Party?
Oh, they actually deserve a lot more blame than the president just laid out. Mm-hmm. Not that he's wrong. He's absolutely right. They knew about the virus in the last months of last year. They did not tell the world. They did not even tell their own people for months. And they deliberately spread it throughout the world. But the rot goes even deeper than that, Steve, because this thing, as I believe the recently escaped Dr. Yen from Hong Kong will be telling the FBI in the next few days, this thing was created in a lab. This is an artificial virus mm-hmm. that was created in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. If you look at the genetic sequence of the virus, it resembles nothing found in nature. It is cobbled together from viruses found in bats and pangolins, and it is something that we've never seen before. That's why it has been so difficult for us to get a handle on it. Because right. it doesn't resemble, it's called a SARS virus. It's not a SARS virus. It's something very different from a SARS virus. So they created it. They let it escape from the lab. And, of course, all the rest is true, that they then spread it around the world. They then withheld information about treatments so that we were sort of left on our own to find out what this novel coronavirus could do to us. And, of course, it's done devastating things to our economy. Fortunately, it's a lot less lethal than we initially thought.
Right.
But should we hold China accountable for all of the cost of doing that to the economy, to the American people, to every lost life? Absolutely.
Right. And speaking of Dr. Yan, I want to play a tape of her, actually, because I think she's an incredibly brave woman. And this is a big development, the fact that we have, you know, at least one known public defector. There's a lot of talk that there are other defectors, you know, that we don't know who are not public yet, that the United States are talking to, people from the Wuhan lab and other places. Dr. Yan was a virology and immunology expert at the Hong Kong School of Public Health. She left Hong Kong because she feared for her safety. Let's hear her in her own words, Dr. Yan.
I tell it in Hong Kong, the moment I start to tell it, I will be disappeared and killed. No one can hear me. So for this purpose, I would like to go to U.S. and tell the truth of the origins of COVID-19 to the world, to let people understand how terrible, how dangerous it is. This is nothing about politics. This is a thing about whether all the humans in the world can survive.
So that is Dr. Yan, who thankfully did get out. She got out of Hong Kong. She is in the United States. She is here and safe, thankfully. But in case you couldn't hear, she's got a thick accent when she speaks English. She said that she would be disappeared and killed if she stayed in Hong Kong. Of all places, Hong Kong, a place that was formerly very free. That's how severe the risks were to her safety if she were to stay there and tell the truth. Your thoughts about the importance of this defection and others, Stephen?
Well, Pam, people need to understand that Dr. Yan was working at the University of Hong Kong, but she was originally from the northern province of Shandong. She was trained in China as a virologist. That means that she has very, very good connections with all the virologists in China and, of course, with the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So I believe, and she's hinted at this, that she has lots of inside information about how this virus was developed, how it was allowed to spread, who were the first people infected, how many people actually died in China, and all the rest. There's a lot more to the story that we don't know. And I believe, being originally from China, she has that story. And make no mistake, they are putting tremendous leverage on her colleagues and her friends back in China.
To hear the complete Steve Cortez interview with Stephen Mosher, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
The fundamental point here is to recognize this is a problem, but it's not the end of the world.
Dennis Prager with Bjorn Lomborg when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Bjorn Lomborg is a Danish author and the president of a great think tank, the Copenhagen Consensus Center. Somewhat early in the global warming scare, Mr. Lomborg published a book, The Skeptical Environmentalist. Lomborg now has a new book. It's called False Alarm. I think you're catching his drift. He joined my colleague, Dennis Prager.
Let's go to your book, False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. This was your suspicion from the outset, which is why I've had you on my show now for so many years. So let's begin with the first part of it. What is the panic part?
So the panic part is really that people are vastly exaggerating the scares on climate change. So let's just get one thing real. Climate change is a real challenge, and it's one that we should fix smartly. But right now, people have gone to extreme lengths of being worried. So, you know, we have a lot of young people who are desperately afraid. So Washington Post showed that 57% of all school kids are now worried about climate change. They're afraid of climate change. And if you ask adults across the world, it turns out that almost half of all adults in 28 countries across the world believe that it's likely global warming will lead to the extinction of the human race. So remember, this is not saying global warming is a problem, which is true and which is what the UN climate panel tells us. They're actually saying this is the end of the world. That's why, you know, so many are now saying it's an existential crisis. That's just simply rubbish, and it's not what the UN climate panel is telling us. And of course, being scared witless doesn't make for good decision making.
I want to repeat that. You said 50% of adults. Is that, did I get that right?
48%, yes.
48% of adults worldwide?
Yes. And 4 out of 10 in the U.S. So you guys are a little bit less worried, but not very much.
Well, if it's 40% in the U.S., 40% of adults in the United States of America believe that there is an imminent doom to humanity because of the climate change, among other things. It's hard to imagine that Joe Biden wouldn't win the election. I mean, just on that alone. I mean, vote for the man who will save humanity.
And that's, of course, why politicians love climate change, because it gets you to say, not only is the world ending, but I will promise to save you. That's the most wonderful thing you can do when you're a politician. And then especially if you get to say, and in climate you do, you get to say, I will save you, and the price tag is going to come in the next election cycle.
When they quote IPCC, the UN Commission on Council on...
Climate Panel, yeah.
Yeah, Climate Panel. Are they quoting, they meaning the panic inducers, that is politicians and media, are they quoting them accurately?
They quote a lot of stuff. So some of it they're quoting accurately, but clearly there is no mention in the UN climate panel about this being the end of the world. They actually and explicitly said that in about 50 years, so in the 2070s, the impact of global warming will be negative. That's why it's a problem. But it will be equivalent to each one of us losing somewhere between 0.2 and 2% of our income. So instead of making, you know, $100,000 in 2075, you will now only make $99,900 something like. But the fundamental point here is to recognize this is a problem, but it's not the end of the world. And I think most people also fail to recognize that the UN expects each person on the planet to be 2.63 times richer than he or she is today by 2075. So what they're basically saying is instead of us being 2.63 times richer by 2075, we will only be 3.56 times richer. Yes, we'll be slightly less, much richer in 2075 because of global warming. That is a problem, but that is not by any stretch of the imagination the end of the world.
So what do you say? I want to throw at you the best known arguments. Look at the glaciers in the Arctic and Antarctic. What do you say to that?
Well, so glaciers are receding, not so much in much of the Antarctic, but they are receding in many places, and that shows global warming is real, and it also is, in the long term, a real problem. But we've got to stop saying, and then we're all going to die, because making that leap, making that very, very simple story that obviously sells a lot more clicks basically makes it impossible to have a sensible conversation about what we should do. If you think the world is ending, you're going to throw everything in the kitchen sink at it. If you realize that it's a problem among many others, you also realize we need to conserve our scarce resources. We need to find smart solutions that are cost-effective, that will actually help the future rather than make it worse.
So you can't yell at this man as a quote-unquote science denier, given the fact that he fully acknowledges the world is getting warmer. So since you label it a panic, what if we did nothing? What would happen?
So doing nothing would be a little worse than being smart about this, because we would forego doing some things that could actually help dealing with climate change and at fairly low cost reduce some of the problems with climate change. The UN climate panel actually tells us if we do nothing about climate change by the 2070s, so in about 50 years' time, the net impact will be at worst equivalent to URI having an income reduction of 2%.
Right, I got
and
that.
And remember,
yes.
By then we'll be much.
Of course. So is all of this that we will be inundated by rising seas, is it a lie?
So it's a little bit of truth and a lot of, making great headlines for newspapers. So take the story that went around the world, and it was heavily featured in Washington Post and many other places, where they told us because of global warming, by the end of the century, 187 million people will have to move. And not surprisingly, many turned that into will drown. It's built on the right idea that because temperature rises, seawater will get warmer. When things like seawater get warmer, they expand, and that means you get sea level rise. So there is a real problem. But what they forgot to remember was to take into account that people actually act. So they were assuming that over the next 80 years, everyone would just sit still, watch the sea level rise, start lapping up over your feet and then your calves and then eventually your hips, and eventually you'd have to move or drown.
For Dennis's complete conversation with Bjorn Lomborg, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up,
we are put in a position right now where every Minneapolis cop feels that they're the next incident. They're scared to death to answer calls in case something turns violent.
Black cops speak out in the final segment of Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt in just a moment. If you enjoy Town Hall Review, and especially if you're a person of faith, let me invite you to listen to another podcast I know you'll enjoy, The Christian Outlook. This week, a look at the debate on sending kids back to school.
The flu is actually more lethal for kids than coronavirus is, yet we have not shut the schools down for an influenza pandemic in many generations.
Ben Carson discusses America.
Why do you think it is that people form caravans trying to get into this country?
A deep dive into the long-term effort to damage the United States.
In recent decades, national belonging has been increasingly stigmatized so that it is an undesirable form of belonging.
And where that is today.
We have seen at a time when racial equality has never been better, the advertising of racial equality is actually having never been worse.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. I'm Mark Davis in for Hugh this week. One of the really amazing aspects of the recent anti-policing demonstration is that black police officers are being attacked right alongside, and in some cases more so than their fellow police officers. So my colleague Larry Elder took a look at news coverage of local police officers in the cities of Portland and Minneapolis. Enjoy this from the Larry Elder Show.
Black Portland officer was asked about the racial protests that have been going on in his city and the kinds of things that have been said to him. Here's what he said.
So what was it like in that capacity in the first few weeks when the fence was up around the Justice Center for that RRT response?
I'll say this. I got to see folks that really do want change, like the rest of us, that have been impacted by racism. And then I got to see those people get faded out by people that have no idea what racism is all about, never experienced racism, that don't even know that the tactics that they are using are the same tactics that were used against my people.
This is a Minneapolis police officer.
Our morale has never been lower.
I think it speaks volumes for the cops who still come to this city every day and still put it all on the line every day. Because, let's be honest, we signed up for this job and we know that death could result in what we do. We know that. But when you have the people, the very people that you are giving your life for to protect, turn on you and make you feel like you're on your own, it wasn't enough to just get disciplined. It wasn't enough to possibly get suspended or fired. We are put in a position right now where every Minneapolis cop feels that they're the next incident. They're scared to death to answer calls in case something turns violent because they're actively trying to send us to prison. Cops are scared of dying, and they're scared of going to prison. It's never been worse.
Meanwhile,
the Trump administration has been intimating an announcement on how it plans to intervene in cities with a rise in violent crime and with, well, governments that are not responding to protect their citizens. The president's decision to stand in solidarity with police, with all law enforcement, has earned him a key endorsement.
And Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, I'm going to play you something he said.
We now have fewer people in our jails than any time since World War II. And we are safer for it and better for it.
Crime up. Shootings up. Homicides up. We have fewer people in jail since World War II, and we're safer because of it? Unreal.
Hey, thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and always sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, and Michael Cook. And let me say once again, thank you to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Mark Davis. Great to be with you this week. Thank you for joining us.